It's Wednesday, December 10th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 127 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 42 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
My name's Chris.
Chris.
Dan.
The listeners either really love charity or they really love you.
They love me.
I don't know
which.
They love
embarrassing you.
So in the last show, of course, we put out the thing there. We put out the actual charity for winning Chris Hussey's love letters. And I didn't have the link at the time because the charity was still trying to get some stuff approved and set up. So right. I got it. Went back just on the show notes and edited it to put the link live.
And we were thinking, man, maybe we should have just done a bunch of chickens and a turkey, when in reality, we should have done a herd of water buffalo.
Yeah, because in less than 24 hours, every single animal on that list was purchased.
Boom, and baby.
I wish I had an exact time, but I can't tell you. All I know is less than 24 hours. So hats off to you guys, because you have shown us yet again that we have the absolute coolest listeners in the history of podcasting.
Phenomenal. I raise my glass to you, listeners.
Absolutely. Me as well.
Everything. It's just whether it's the way that you guys treat the guys serving drinks at Fear the Con or the charities that we've been involved in or whatever. Just every time. Just absolutely above and beyond. So excellent job.
So when am I reading them?
No, you don't. It was all a big con.
That's
just a fake site redirecting into Dan's pal.
I'm rich.
Oh.
Whoa. No.
Chris, what you're going to do?
Yes.
Do you want to read them or do you want me to read them?
Oh, you know, I think As sexy and as handsome as your voice may be, I think it would be best if I read them, only because I think people would, A, get a better feel for, you know, me as a younger man, and then also, I would have the proper tone and intonation going into these letters.
All right, then what I want you to do is you get those letters handy.
I don't think you could read these with a straight face, Dan.
No, I probably would not.
We are going to do these love letters on a bonus episode that we'll release this week at the absolute latest next week. I don't want to jerk people around on this, so we're going to get that out there quick. So, Chris, you get those handy. If we've got enough time, maybe even tonight, we will record that bonus episode. If not tonight, then we will definitely do that later this week and get that out there. They gave us our livestock, so we're going to give them your love letters.
I am holding them in my hand right now.
And, you know, Chris, kudos to you for having a good sense of humor about this.
Well, you know, it's a safe piece of gaming wonderfulness and geekness that I can actually look back at and feel kind of proud of. And primarily,
this really does put several punches in Chris's geek cred card.
Absolutely,
that's for sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a happy ending because we ended up getting married. I mean, it probably would be very depressing and awful.
I bet it was a happy ending.
Had she dumped me, you know, after getting all these letters saying, "Look, I can't do this anymore. I don't know exactly what you're trying to accomplish."
Too much of a dork.
Yeah.
I need an actual human being. You know.
One other quick congratulation. The GM profile contest has ended, and Keith Curtis is the winner. We will be sending him his stuff. So, Keith, I think I have your mailing address, but just to be sure, send it to me in a PM, and I will get the Lord of the Rings book and also the gift card, write a check and cough it up again, sent off to you.
Oh, yeah, I do know where it is.
Okay, good. Fearthecon.com. Definitely right. Get out there, get your tickets purchased. If you're interested in running a game, be sure to contact chad@feartheboot.com. We've got some good games up there and running. We need to get some more up there.
We need game masters. It's basically like going to a club and, you know, there's ladies' night where all ladies drink free. And the reason they do that is to get the guys to come in. Well, it's the same thing here. We need game masters to run games to get the gamers to come in.
Alrighty, we got something else. I said I wasn't going to let this run very long, and even in the short amount of time it ran, we got a pretty good amount of feedback here, so we're going to start tearing through these. This is the Fear the Boots, Screw the Game. We were out there searching through the minds of our listeners to find creative ways that you, the player, can screw the game or game system that you are currently playing in, and we've got some good stuff. A lot of it's D&D, but not all of it. So let's start going through these. Some of these are actually pretty freaking funny. This is one somebody sent me. It's actually not credit. I don't have a name on this guy, and I don't want to give his email address, so we'll just call him that guy.
He's that guy.
That guy comes up with a combination of the... This is a recommendation for D&D 3.5. Okay, so if you're playing D&D 3.5, open up the Complete Warrior book. I tell you, almost every one of these for D&D involves one of these fringe source books. There's a reason why we at Fear the Boot have never been in favor of all of these class-specific supplement books, because they break the game, and you guys have demonstrated they break the game in ways I didn't even dream up. So here's one from the Complete Warrior. It has a feat called Monkey Grip.
Oh my!
Which allows
I've heard of that.
Yeah, I've used that actually.
You know, I actually prefer the Stranger, but I mean,
yes, but the monkey's good on certain days of the week.
That is true.
Yeah.
So the Monkey Grip allows you to use a larger weapon than usual.
Yeah, it does.
Sure does.
-2 penalty rather than a -4 penalty. There is also something in the Magic Item Compendium called Strong Arm Bracers, which allows for a larger weapon still and with no penalty. Now, if you stack these two, a medium-sized character can wield a huge weapon at only a -2 penalty, and a large character can wield a gargantuan weapon at a -2 penalty. Now, if you're curious what that translates to, that would mean a medium-sized character, I'm taking this out of the Monstrous Manual, I looked up under Giants and Ogres to get the damages on their weapons, a regular medium-sized character could wield a weapon that does 2d8 damage. A large character could wield a weapon that does 4d6 damage. That's before you even get to any kind of strength bonus or level bonus. It's just straight off the shelf. The second combo, this one goes a little bit over my head because it pulls on some source books I'm not familiar with. The second combo is a defensive one. Combine the druid spell Anti-Life Shell, which repels most living things at 10 feet away. Ice Shield from a book called Frostburn, which gives damage resistance 15, but it also gives you a weakness to fire. And then Energetic Healing from the Book of Exalted Deeds, which gives immunity to an energy type, in this case you pick fire, and heals 0.1 of the intended damage. And so the Anti-Life Shell is going to get rid of most of your melee attackers, and pretty much anything else coming in you're going to absorb and heal from.
Jeez.
The last breaking combo he has is if you take Create Water, which at least in 3rd edition was 2 gallons per level, dump it all over the ground, cast Flash Freeze from the Frostburn book to make it ice, and then cast Hibernal Healing, which is also from Frostburn, which allows you to absorb the ice back and heal yourself.
Oh, God.
And then my head exploded.
This one's from Valetta Vadum. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not pronouncing it right,
you should have picked it into your name.
Yeah, you should have renamed yourself Bob for the sake of this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Stone to Flesh specifically mentions as one of its functions that can turn a statue into a corpse.
Ew.
Well, now this is for D&D 3.5 as well.
Abe Lincoln.
This is for D&D 3.5. Now, of course, I don't know why they didn't.
Giant Abe Lincoln zombie.
Well, I don't know why they didn't think this through, because, of course, in D&D, corpses have all kinds of other uses. Mm. So you turn this statue into a corpse. There are a lot of fun, interesting ways to abuse that detail, not all of them evil. But the absolute most broken is to make statues of templated creatures, like a couple dozen dead half-dragon, half-celestial, half-fiend, paragon, paranatural goblins. The result is a goblin with abilities that are absolutely godly in pretty much every respect. Then you bring them all to life as zombies. Necromancers are limited by the total hit dice of their zombies, but with these goblins, they're technically one-hit die creatures. It's just they have all kinds of bonus, because the way monsters work in 3rd edition, you have templates you can apply on top of a monster type. So this thing's walking around with an arsenal of unbelievable powers, was technically just a level 1 monster.
That's really dumb. Not the idea, but I mean,
the fact that that's possible.
Yeah, the fact that you can do it, yeah.
Can you really do that, or is someone taking liberty with the rules on that one?
To me, that's like the player who comes to you, and they're like, oh, I'm going to do this, and this, and this, and this. And I'm like, but how does your character feel about that? And they look at me, and they go, feel?
Huh.
Exactly. I did have a player who was notorious for being very, I mean, he's a great guy, but he was notorious for being just a terrible, terrible power gamer. I mean, just really abusing the rules beyond recognition, to the point where we were playing one time, I had blinded him, and he ended up using the rules against me by casting True Strike and some other combination. I just sat there and looked at him like, are you really seriously doing this? And he, of course, points to the book and, you know, whatever.
Well, see, that's the point. Is, you know, all these game breakers, they're not supposed to be sensible, per se.
Yeah.
You know, I think
he's violating the spirit of the law.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of the book. Well, nonetheless, the letter of the law allows it.
Is this Gary Gygax's game, or is this my game? That's what ultimately comes
it is. What the guy says is true, though. I just flipped open to Stone to Flesh, and it's completely true. It does say you can turn a statue into a corpse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you turn around with necromancy, you can start bringing them back as whatever.
But as a game master, what do you do? Do you look at the player and say, no, I'm not letting you do that because it's just stupid. Ridiculous. They say, no, you can't. Yeah, you can't tell me to stop because it's the rules. And what are we going to say? It's like, are the rules at your whim? This is the basis. This is the consistency within the universe. Well,
where I would go on this particular one, if I was
still
running,
say no, but
if I was running the game and the guy did this,
yeah,
I'm a big believer in Ferris, so I would let him do it. But here's where I would take it. You can have under, I think it's like skeletons or something. Now, granted, he's talking about zombies here. I guess you got a corpse. It's not quite a skeleton, but you have under the skeletons that depending on the structure of the monster, the structure of the skeleton, it's still functionally a skeleton. It just has different hit dice and maybe slightly different characteristics. And I'd go kind of that route where I'd be like, well, you have a really bizarre looking zombie, but it's still just a zombie. But
that's not what the rules say.
I think
say.
In that one, they added where you were talking about stacking templates upon the corpse. That's where it's kind of like, how did that get there? It's like, well, He was saying, well, I make the statue of this goblin, dragonoid, you know, godlike thing. It's like, well, that's really not what the statue was. If I'm understanding that correctly.
If I was running this, I would make all the artisans refuse to make him statues. Just on principle alone.
Yeah.
No self-serving sculptor is going to make you any statues, no matter how much money you throw at them.
Yeah.
And then he would have to travel across country to find ones that would do it, then I would attack him with a red dragon on the way there and kill him.
To me, this is where it stops being a story and character driven role playing game and becomes more of a tactical game.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I think what you're gonna run into some of these instances that Dan's gonna be bringing up here, some of these are purely an abuse of the rule as it's written, and it's not. And that's it. I mean, it's right. Just the rules, you know, this rule says this, this, and this, like the first one that you brought up or the first couple that you brought up with the stacking the spells, that's perfectly doable. This one, this last one you're talking about, there's some wavy magic in there a little bit. And then some of the other ones can be like, the DM's just going to be able to say, no, right. You can't do that or, you know, something like that. But I actually, the ones that I like the best are the ones where it's just where you literally you're exploiting the rule where it's been broken. And I like that because what that says to the game designers, and I know, and I like those to be pointed out because what that says to the game designers and the game companies are, you didn't think your game through well enough.
You know, it's
you put out this product and boom, here it is.
We're falling into a side discussion that I think is fairly interesting, which is, would we as game masters allow this kind of stuff? How would we respond to each of these requests?
Mm-hmm. I think it really depends on how it's presented to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's obvious the guy is like bending the rules over backwards, but is he being interesting? Is it fitting his character? Is it fitting within the framework of the story that everyone agreed that we're playing? I mean, it's like, okay, we're playing a low magic D&D game with some small amount of magic, and then, you know, it's this kind of story and it's this kind of this and that. And he's like, well, I can do this game breaking thing. He's telling me this, and he's like, I can do A, B, and C combo together, and it breaks the game, but it doesn't fit within what we're trying to do here. You know, it's
the way I deal with this is I try to deal with most of it up front. If I'm running D&D, those ridiculous source books, they do not come in. I'll use a player's handbook, the DM's guide, maybe a realm setting book.
And something balanced like the Psionic handbook.
Yeah. Well, the newer one's not as bad.
Yeah.
But
throw it out the window.
The point is I just don't even allow these books because it always gets obscene like this. Yeah. But during the game, my players generally don't do this to me because of the fact that I'm not doing it to them. And I've played in games where
I
really felt like the GM from top to bottom is trying to do this to me anyway. Every time I do something, every time a monster does something, they're going to use every little bit of the rules to get me. And I don't know if
playing a lot of games like that.
I don't know if to them that they think
this
is
problem
challenging or if they think that this is just their role as a GM. But this just entices me to kind of fight back. And then what really gets my goat is when I turn around and I do something, they're just screwing me 10 ways to Sunday. I turn around and do something similar in return and they just flip out because that violates the spirit of, and I don't think the game was meant to allow that. And on, And it's like, yeah, get real.
Yeah.
You know, I do think, though, that there's a natural tendency of people to, you know, get in a competitive nature when it's something like that. You know, whether you're the player who feels like you're being abused by the DM throwing all these things at you, or if you're the GM feeling abused because the players are killing everything that you're throwing at them, and you lose that focus on exactly what you're supposed to be really trying to do, and you can get into that competitive thing and then start really, you know, smacking everybody around.
Mm-hmm. I know that, and this will sort of forecast, I think, one of the ones that you're going to talk about, but in most of the games that I've ever played, especially fantasy-oriented or D&D-oriented specifically, one of the first rules that was out of the mouth of the GM was, yeah, there's no wish in this game. That spell doesn't exist. You know,
yeah.
And spells of that nature. You could just say, and I think that one, though, is an easy one,
yeah,
because as a GM, really, you have control of the spells that exist in your world or in the world that they're going to encounter. They've got to get it somewhere. And if you don't basically allow them to, if you don't have it in the game, they can't get it or find it or whatever else.
One of the things I learned from Dan back when we were teenagers and playing games like this, and everybody was trying to get the biggest gun and all that sort of stuff, is that when somebody said something like, you know, we're playing a sci-fi game, let's say, and it's like, well, I'm taking this perk that allows me to have access to this level of technology, and then I'm taking this perk that gives me all kinds of money, and you know what I can buy with it? He's like, what? A briefcase nuke! And it's like, yeah, sure enough, it's in the rules. But I tell you what, you can have a briefcase nuke, that's fine with me. But the bad guys get briefcase nukes,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. If people in my game wanted to roll up office workers,
mm-hmm,
with nothing but one can of mace between them as a weapon, I'll tone the game accordingly.
Yeah.
If they want to roll out in powered armor with heavy miniguns, I'm going to...
You're not going to send Joe the plumber.
You know, with Wish specifically, and you can do this even not just with the enemies, but kind of with game mechanics all over. Let's take Wish as an example. If they somehow get a wish in the game, if they make a reasonable wish, I'll do it and I won't screw with them.
Sure.
If they wish for something unreasonable, it becomes a monkey paw wish. So if they wish to go up 10 levels... they appear about 80 feet up in the air and fall from there. If they want 1,000 gold coins in their hand, guess what? Better find a doctor.
And you're right. That's a good way to do it. I mean, well, it's a good twist. So
let's read another one here. We got a bunch of, let's read another one here. This is another one from 3.5. I think this one's pretty funny. There's a feat called Improved Mini Shot that makes each of your shots in the mini shot use separate attack rolls. Then there's an enchantment in the Champions of Ruin Forgotten Realms supplement called Splitting that causes each arrow to split into two arrows, each with their own attack roll. A rogue using this combination of feats at high level can effectively sneak attack 12 times at close range. That particular tip came from Ember Corvus.
I will not sit at that man's table.
I got to flip ahead to one who just cracks me up.
It's actually
the next one here in the list, but... before you want to do the wish one, actually wasn't the one I was looking for, but you want to do the wish one? This one, it took me a minute to actually wrap my head around what this guy was doing, but once I figured it out, it's brilliant in its simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
This one comes from Rifkin, and Rifkin says, this part cracks me up before I get to his tip. Okay, first to preface this, I'm the type of nerd that has the WotC hotline in my phone and I use it. I call them and ask about things like this, and their reply was, I don't know a single DM that would allow that. But after asking it if it was legal by the letter of the law.
Yeah.
All right. So this is in D&D 3.5. This is a wish one.
Wait a minute. WotC has a hotline you can call?
I did not know this. So we're going to have to call them live on the air sometime and just prank call them about something ridiculous.
Like, it's outrageous. I mean, it's like...
start asking questions.
I've got a rules question. I mean, what do you ask these people? Are they open... you know, 24/7. I mean,
we should call WotC and start asking for rules help with Pathfinder.
Do they have an India call center?
Probably. I mean,
that's
all right. So D&D 3.5
blows my mind for some reason.
The best spell to break is Wish. Now he starts quoting from parts of Wish. Now here's one, page 302, or at least I don't have a 3.5 in front of me, but he says on page 302, the seventh bullet point of things that Wish can do,
mm-hmm,
is create a magical item or add to the powers of an existing item. Okay, so a wish can create any magical item you want.
Any magical item.
Okay. The Ring of Three Wishes has three rubies, each containing a wish spell.
Uh-huh.
And at first, the way he phrased it took me a little bit to wrap my head a lot around this. But if you take a ring, mm-hmm, or you take a wish spell, you can wish for a Ring of Three Wishes, which give you three wishes.
Yep.
You can then use each of those three wishes to wish for 3 rings of wishes. Yep. Now you have 9, then 27. And there's a specification in the rule that says you cannot wish for more wishes. But he's not wishing for more wishes.
No.
He's wishing for a magical item, which is within the list of things that you can select off of this.
Again, it's just, like you said, the way they worded it, it's just an oversight on the game designers.
See, I don't know, though. See, I would actually debate that one, because yes, you are wishing for a magic item, but the item that you are wishing for is a ring of 3 wishes. And so that item is an item that contains wishes. So
but it's
that,
not a wish. It's an item.
Yeah.
But yet, at the same time, you can't wish for more wishes, but that item contains wishes. So you're still wishing for more wishes, even though you're housing in an item. See, to me, you are definitely, that wouldn't be allowed, only because, to me, that is an item that contains wishes, and you are wishing for those wishes.
Mm.
Even though they may be in that item.
This is the one I was looking for. This is the one that cracks me up. This comes from Hackdoor. I was listening to the latest episode, and I remember the old greased turkey tactic some players of mine would pull. Here's what it is. All you need, items needed, a 450 gold piece item called Qual's Feather Token, Swan Boat, and the first level spell Grease. The item is described as follows. A token that forms a swan-like boat capable of moving on water at a speed of 60 feet. It can carry 8 horses and gear or 32 medium characters of any equivalent combination. The boat lasts for 1 day.
It's a big boat.
What his group would do is they would create this boat. They would cast Grease, not on the floor, but on the keel of the boat, mm-hmm. which the spell specifically says you can do stuff like that. It doesn't say boat, but it says you can put it on items, mm-hmm. making the items extremely slippery, at which point they would launch this boat full of people and horses down the hallway of a dungeon.
Wow.
That's funny.
That's like reverse bowling.
I know, that's hysterical.
Grease is one of the great spells, first level spells to abuse.
Chris, we did a lot of abuse. Have people really been abusive in your games?
Not to that level. Good gravy. But to a certain extent, yes, there's always been that one player who does like to go and abuse the rules. A specific example, he was a sorcerer. We were doing 3-0. And he was a sorcerer, and he was really the most powerful fighter in the party, because he was a sorcerer that, and I'll take some of the blame for this because I allowed certain things, but he was a sorcerer who made gross use of haste and true strike and was wielding a greatsword. Oh no, he actually had a mercurial greatsword, so he could even cause more damage with that. So he would use haste to up his strength. And then he would then cast True Strike on himself, so he would always get that plus 20 to hit. So he basically would hit every time and do tremendous amounts of damage. And then the haste would continue, because in 3-0 the haste just lasted forever and a day. And he would just basically go zipping around, just completely destroying everything, because he would basically use his 2 actions to cast True Strike and then make an attack roll. Basically almost every round.
I was just curious about this because. As we're sitting here reading through these, I find it fascinating. Listen to the reactions of everyone here. I find these funny. Chad seems to disagree with them and find them unnecessary. But Chris, you just seem to just squeal every time I read one of these.
Well, there's two sides for me in this. On the one side, I got to respect somebody's devotion to examining the rules with that fine tooth comb to get these tremendous rule screws. But at the other side, it's like, it almost, you reading these, just almost in a certain way, it makes my skin crawl, because it's like, why? What is the point? Do you just want to do this to ruin everybody else's fun? Is that what makes the game enjoyable for you? I mean, I get the fun in doing that because, yeah, it's fun. And everybody loves to go on a rule screw power trip every now and again. But to do it on a consistent basis, which really most of these really aren't necessarily that way. But to do that on a consistent basis, it's just something that just kind of just rubs me the wrong way.
All right. Well, let me run these two past you, because these next two, these really aren't just 2 or 3 of them like this. These really aren't per se cheating the game. You're not doing things that clearly designers never intended. These, in my mind, sound like clever uses of existing spells that don't require a long reach to do. This one comes from Nathan, who's Cthulhu's Pinky on our forum. His recommendation is cast Silence on a fighter because it gives you the ultimate move silent ability regardless of how you're equipped.
Yeah.
So you create what is supposed to be a negative spell for somebody else, mm-hmm. and instead use it as a positive spell on yourself.
I've done that many, many times in the past. And what we would do is we would cast not even on like on our armor. I would cast it like on a stone, and then you'd carry it with you, because the thing about silence is it's either cast in an area and it's static, you know, it stays there. Or if you cast on an object, you can take it with you. And what we would do then is the nice thing about that is you could take it and get it near the spellcasters. And I think I may be wrong, but at least at one point, I think if you used to dispel, you had to know like what it was on to be able to dispel it. So if you're just dispelling like the,
it'd be great to put it on your rock. If there's a bunch of guards around the corner, throw the rock around the corner. They won't hear the rock hit down.
And that's what we would do.
Yeah.
And
yeah. If you have a sling or even just a good throwing arm,
that is a great spell to abuse. Silence is a horrible spell to abuse that way. And we did it.
But see, to me, something like that where you cast it on the armor, to me, that is being smart tactics, because, and I could even see some role-playing justification for that thing. You've got this fighter clanking around all the time, making all this noise, and the wizard, who's, you know, either wearing just his loose clothes or his robes, is never making sound, and he gets finally so irritated at the fighter always rousting out all the monsters, he finally decides to do something, take matters into his own hands, and shut the fighter up by casting mm-hmm. silence on him. That, you know, so I can see that going on, but then to have, you know, someone sit there and grease up a boat and slide it down the hallway,
awesome. That's unmitigated success.
It's a great visual image, but I can't realistically justify that unless you're playing a comical game. It's like, for example, to give you a better example, it's equivalent to the guy who has continual light cast on a stone, then takes a scroll case, a horn scroll case, cuts off the tip, and then wedges the stone in there, so he's got his
own so complex
flashlight.
I always just cast continue light on the end of a stick and mm-hmm. put a rag over it to essentially
focus the beam. How, you know, if you're thinking of this, why are you adventuring? You should be an inventor. You know,
if you're going to invent
a flashlight, then
if you're a wizard, why don't you start a sideline business of the cheapest, easiest magical item to make in the game? Continual light torches. They last forever. And you don't have to sell them. Oh, we're an adventure party. We're going down to the dungeon to kill and loot and kill and loot. No,
you sell
farmers,
them to peasants.
Yeah, I mean, even in modern day, there are third world villages where they can't get light. I mean, you think in the Middle Ages they mm-hmm. want some light, too?
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
But no, you had to kill and loot.
Yep.
That's what D&D is. Kill more monsters, get more stuff.
Yeah, Continual Flame is the third edition equivalent. It's a level 2 wizard spell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Here's another one.
I just had a guy do that in my game this past weekend.
This one strikes me more as the game breaking itself. This was sent to me by a guy living in London who pronounces his name Mihao, his name looks nothing like Mihao, but that's how he says it's pronounced. So
how does it look?
It looks like Mikkel or Michael, but it's pronounced Mihao. His suggestion, Mihao's suggestion, actually comes from a friend of his, and here's what his friend sent him. Bugbear rogues. Apparently this is something you can do in 4th edition. Bugbear rogues are truly brutal because they get a +2 dex and a +2 strength stat and have oversized weapon damage, meaning they can use larger weapons. And as a result, it is possible to sneak attack for 3d8 +7 at level 1.
Oh, those are awesome.
In D&D, here's another one. D&D 3.0 Magic of Faerun. I think they just didn't playtest this very well. There's a first edition. This one comes, by the way, from Rachel Storm. There's a first edition cleric spell called Wield Skill. And apparently it's not in the 3.5 edition. It was only in the original. And the spell effect gives you +10 to any skill, including skills you don't have. So if you apply this to same like concentration, tumbling, diplomacy, bluff, you basically become exceptionally good at anything for 10 minutes per level.
Wow.
Yikes.
And they took it out in 3.5.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's do some that are not from D&D. Actually, I've got a bunch here that are not Dungeons & Dragons related, just for anyone.
Oh, it's good to see that we can break games other than just D&D.
Absolutely.
Well, I think D&D is the easiest to break.
I do, too.
Because of the fact that you have, number one, so much material. And if you write that much, you're going to screw up somewhere. And then secondly, so much of it is spell powers that are really not quantified. They don't do a certain amount of damage. They have these sort of qualified effects on the world that are easy to manipulate and use in ways that mm-hmm. they really were not meant to, but don't technically violate the rules. Other games, a little bit harder because they have either less material or less magic, or in some cases, both. I'll go and throw out one here. This is not exactly game-breaking, but it's a great min-maxing tip. This is something I figured out from my years of playing Battletech. If you look at, in mech design, at the speed of a mech versus its engine, there's a diminishing return on the engine. Okay, so a little mech running at a certain speed will need a smaller engine than a big mech running at the same speed. But as the mechs get bigger, they also have more and more available space to work with. And if you look at that, you actually add up the cockpit weight, the structure weight, all the kind of minimal stuff that has to go on a mech. There is a break point where you get an optimal weight to speed for every speed. For example, you can get the most stuff on a 580 mech at 75 tons. You can get the most stuff on an 812 mech at, I think it was 55 tons. Now, the tip here in that is a lot of people design 100-ton mechs that go 4.6, but you actually lose tonnage doing that. You will get more stuff on your mech going 4.6 at 95 tons than you will at 100 tons. So if you're into Battletech mech design, play around with the tonnage. Here's one from GURPS. This one breaks my mind, but here's another one. The more stuff you put out, the more problems you're going to create.
That sounds like relationship advice.
These next few come from Shane. I got a couple here. The first one's for GURPS. Basically, what the guy says is GURPS has a point buy system with advantages and disadvantages. And I can't remember what they're called in GURPS, but I know what he's talking about. I just played GURPS. There's a trait you can take to be a Siamese twin, a conjoined twin, or basically you have another person physically attached to you. And what he did was he took that trait and then he started piling on disadvantages like blind, deaf, mute, and giving them to the other twin. So his twin is basically a walking disadvantage battery.
Wow.
And then of course the first thing he does when he gets his character is go into surgery to get that twin removed.
Uh-huh. Give the twin bad luck and
wow.
Make the twin poor so you can buy wealth. And
why would such a disadvantage be available in the first place? You have the disadvantage of being a conjoined twin. I mean, why would that even be in the game to begin with?
That's a very good question. The follow-up question to that is, why would a GM allow him to take that combination of disadvantages?
Unless you're doing GURPS Circus Freaks, I can't see any supplement that such a thing would be necessary. Great,
GURPS Carnies.
Look, if anyone else is a conjoined twin or knows one, that's Pat at Fear the Boot, Chris at Fear the Boot.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and put a call out for somebody to run GURPS Carnies at Fear the Con.
I'm playing a woman. I don't like it when male characters play female characters. I'm going to take the perk of huge beard. You're in.
His next two, this is still from Shane. These are both from Deadlands. There's a magic spell in Deadlands, or a magic hex, rather, in Deadlands called Magic Bullet. And it lets you roll to hit someone again after shooting someone else, using the location of the first target as a point from which to measure range to the second target. And if you do well enough, you're allowed to do it on a third, a fourth, and a fifth. Well, apparently the way the numbers work out, if you take a really, really mega-powered gun and you've got a group of, like, bunch of guys coming at you from a long distance and you're willing to throw in some fate chips, you can pound off a bullet at the farthest guy and just kill everyone in the lineup.
Wow.
Wow.
Another one he gave, he said he's not sure on the name of this hex, but there's one that upgrades the damage of your gun, and if you apply this with a decent draw skill and a Gatling pistol, you could fire three bullets doing 3d20 damage instead of 3d6.
I'll tell you, I love the Deadlands system, but what I found in playing it is that damn draw system really can work against you. And there would be times where I would draw 10 cards or whatever, and I couldn't get anything better than a damn pair. So...
You know, and that was one of the things I loved about it, because that made it risky. You know, casting a spell wasn't as easy as just saying, I'm casting a spell.
No,
I mean,
no.
You're taking your character's life into your hands at that point.
Because you got the Jokers in there, and if you draw either of the Jokers, it's bad, but especially if you draw the Black Joker, then you're screwed. But like I said, there are some of those hexes that you had to draw like a royal flush to get them to go off or to get them to walk really well. And I'm like, I don't see how the hell you would ever get that. There's just... Unless you're cheating and stacking the deck, I don't see how you would ever get that lucky.
Well, say, having played poker quite a bit throughout my life, I don't think I've ever seen a royal flush at a table.
Exactly.
Ever.
I mean, it's rare enough. I mean, you know, you'll a lot of them are better, like, you know, a pair or three jacks. Even three jacks is hard to get, but, you know, you get up into some of the big ones, like the really high power hexes were high cards. Like, you know, the minimum thing you had to draw would be like a full house.
Well, so you play poker, like, and you draw any better than a pair and you're feeling pretty comfortable with your hand.
Yes.
So, huh. This one comes from Brian, and he starts off by saying it's nice to finally be an Arliss celebrity after he was on our GM profile. And we're mentioning you a second time, Brian, so you're now a Q-list celebrity, right? And again, we might get you up to a P-list. His tip, and this actually isn't per se breaking the game, because apparently it's a part of the game, but play the new version of Paranoia. It is designed for the players to try and screw the GM by spending perversity points with the ability to designate narrow specialties at any moment in the game. So, for example, is the door you need to get through blocked by a giant war robot? Your character suddenly has always had the kick war robots in the right spot to turn them off ability. Here's one from Legend of the Five Rings. I'll give this one. It's kind of written in long form, but it's a great tip. This is from Eric. Eric lives in Japan. And so, Eric, I apologize. And I may not even try to pronounce some of the names of the stuff in here, because I'm going to butcher them. He says a Legend of the Five Rings tip. And if you play a samurai from the Lion Clan, you have an ability that allows you to ignore the difficulty armor provides. Because in the edition that he's playing, and I know Legend of Fire has two or three different rule systems, but in the version he's playing, the armor adds to the difficulty of the attack, kind of like, you know, it does in D&D. And so there's an ability that the Lion Clan can get, which allows them to ignore the difficulty of intervening armor. Well, they also put an arrow type in the game, and I have to pronounce this, just tell you what it's called, Watakushi. If I'm butchering that, just take the phonetic. It's designed to do an insane amount of damage, but its balancer is that your intervening armor becomes much tougher. So it's meant so that your armor is really going to screw this thing up, except if you have that Lion Clan perk, you ignore the armor anyway. Mm. So basically you get the one-shot kill straight through the armor.
Wow.
This last one, this isn't signed, so I can't tell you who it's by. I'm just going to want to be reading off people's email addresses. But this is one for World of Darkness. And it's fairly long. Actually, if you're listening to this, get on the forum and post this on the forum, because I don't want to read this whole thing on there. It's good stuff, but it's really long. But the basics of what he's saying is, when you create a character, think about the character in terms of character advancement. Because if you know character advancement plays out a certain way point-wise, then you can build the character up front to be easier to advance. For example, one of the things that he suggested was it costs you 5 points per level of a new attribute. So to go from 2 to 3 would be 15 points. To go from 3 to 4 would be 20 points. Okay. So what he's recommending is that, for example, if you're playing New World of Darkness, because of the fact that it costs a lot more to advance a high level attribute, you're actually better off. If you look at what it would take to completely max out a character from different starting points, you are better off concentrating your attributes and skills into a narrow set of areas, because now you are buying off the top levels. The only thing he doesn't recommend is don't do 5-point buys, because those cost 2 points in character creation, make them even less efficient. So basically buy everything you could get up to level 4. And then when you actually go to advance the character, you're working from the bottom up. Now, that's not going to work in like D&D, because you're just getting raw levels. But any game where you get a block of points to spend how you please, that's going to work for. If you look at what is it going to take to advance this character and use that sort of as a template for creating the character.
I think MechWarrior 2 was like that.
Yes, it was. MechWarrior 2 actually had a peculiar thing in character advancement that I'm not saying it's unique in games, but it's certainly rare, in that the way your character played in the game actually figured into advancement. For example, like if you rolled snake eyes or boxcars in any skill, that figured into the advancement of that skill.
That's right.
Great success and great failure taught you something. You didn't just like... That's one of the things I've never really liked about most character advancement stuff, is you spend your day running around, flying a spaceship and doing trade deals, and you get some points to advance your character, and I'm all in favor of that. But then suddenly you spend it on sailing. And it's like, I mean, I know, okay, you can explain.
You gotta have a hobby.
Yeah, I mean, you can explain this, and maybe it's a hobby. But one thing I always made my characters or my players do in games that had those point by advancements was I made them look forward to the advancement. And I don't mean look forward as in, you know, anxiously anticipate, but look forward as in think forward. If you're going to advance this character and you want to get another level of guns and you haven't done any shooting, you better be doing something to convince me that when that time comes around, there's a sensible reason why you've improved in this area. you know, maybe that's target shooting somewhere, or I don't know what, but...
Yeah. In Earthdawn, you had to, when you wanted to improve your talents before you could advance to the, you know, the next circle, which was their level equivalent, you had to use those talents that you had at your current level. You had to use them successfully at least once, which... for certain talents, made things very difficult because sometimes it required you to be in a special situation. So you were kind of at the mercy of what was going on around you and the situations your GM would put you through before you could even have the opportunity to advance, which, you know, get a little stressful at times when you've got everything else ready to go except for just that one talent that you can't quite find a use for.
I want to thank everyone for sending these in. This was a ton of fun to do, and I don't know if we'll do something quite like this again in the future, but if we get some of the stuff in, if there's really funny ones, I might give a mention here or there on the show. I realize we're wrapping up this episode a little bit early, but that's because Chris has to split from our recording session here in a little bit, so we want to be sure to get that bonus episode done. So we are going to sign out here, but what we're going to do is we are going to, rather than waiting until later this week, we are going to record that bonus episode right now. So you expect to see Chris's love letters drop by tomorrow. So we're going to drop within 24 hours. Since you guys took care of those livestock within 24 hours, we are going to drop this bonus episode within 24 hours.
And then 24 hours after that, Chris's pants are going to drop.
That's right.
And then all going to reject me.
No, my, the power that we're giving
that's
listeners.
The part we keep that's for right. ourselves. So
they're going to start making terrible, terrible demands.
We're taking pictures, and we're auctioning that off for the herd of water buffaloes next week.
So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you for a bonus episode tomorrow.
See ya.
Later.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.